It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and the Libertarian Institute. Today, we have Dr. Michael Humer. He is the author of Knowledge, Reality, and Value, a mostly common sense guide to philosophy. Dr. Humer, where is the best place to buy this excellent book?
So the e-version and the paperback are on Amazon. The hardcover is on Barnes & Noble, because Amazon doesn't do hardcovers.
Okay, got it. What is philosophy?
Okay. Well, it's hard. So as I say in the book, you can't actually define it, but don't worry, because you can't define anything else either. But the way that you get most concepts is by seeing examples of them. You know, like when you're explaining what green is, the way you do that is by showing somebody some green things, not by giving them a definition of green. So the way that people learn what philosophy is by seeing some examples of philosophy, right? So I like to give examples like, the ship of Theseus problem, and then you can observe some things about that. I don't know if the listeners all know what this problem is, right? But briefly, there's a ship that Theseus is sailing his ship around the Mediterranean Sea for like a decade or something, and he's periodically replacing individual pieces of the ship. And then you imagine that at the end of 10 years, the whole thing, every piece has been replaced, but not all at once. They were replaced, individual pieces at different times until eventually all of them were replaced. And then you have the question at the end of the 10 years, was it still the same ship? Still have the ship that he had at the beginning. Okay, and I like this as an example of philosophy because you can very clearly see that this is not a scientific question, not a religious question either. You know, it's not any other kind of question besides a philosophical question, right? You can see some things about this. So like, you can see that there could be arguments on either side of this. That is a sort of thing that is controversial. It's like, it's not obvious what the answer is. At the same time, it's not a scientific question because you can see like there's no scientific investigation to do that would help. Like it's not like, oh, if we do some really careful measurements, we'll find out if it was the same ship, right? Well, there's no experiment that you can do, right? But there are sort of rational, intuitive arguments that you can give for why it is or isn't the same ship, right? And it's not just all your opinion or whatever, and you don't just like express your feelings, right? So like the argument that it's the same ship is, if you only replaced one piece, you would think it was still the same ship, right? All right, so you take the ship at the beginning and then the ship after you replace one, those are the same, right? And then the ship after you replace one piece is the same as the ship after you replace two pieces, right? Okay, so if you buy that, then you can just go all the way to the end, and then by the transitivity of identity, you can get that the first ship was the same ship as the last one, right? At the same time, you can see that there's an argument against it being the same because it's got like 0% overlap, the components of the first one. Okay, and so this is, and I bring this up not because the ship of Theseus is intrinsically such an important problem, right? There's not that much discussion of it, right? But because it's a good example of a philosophical issue, right? Also note that it's kind of fundamental because like this sort of problem applies to every object that has a lot of parts, which is almost everything, right? So it's a fairly sweeping issue. If it's not the same ship, then actually you're probably not the same person who was here, 10 years ago. Because individual atoms got replaced in your body, right? Like all the objects around us are not the same anymore, right? So, okay. So anyway, that was all a long lead in to your question of what philosophy is. Like, okay, and I could give lots of other examples of, philosophical questions, which would then give the audience a better sense of what philosophy is about, but it would take a long time, I have to get some discussion of.
Yeah, that's what the excellent books are for. And I'm curious why you think philosophy is important. People, there's the Family Guy joke of Peter becomes a philosopher and all he does is say, why? Like in response to everything. He never answers anything. People will often think of philosophy as something that just intellectuals do that has nothing to do with my everyday life, kind of a trivial endeavor. Why is philosophy important?
Yeah, so first, philosophers don't generally just sit around saying why. they generally try to present arguments for an answer to one of these puzzling questions, right? And you know, why is it important? I mean, a lot of the philosophical questions are really of central import to just your understanding of the world and your place in it. So you know, you have questions like, how should we live? And you know, it's like that seems kind of important, right? As a general, and notice that that's not a scientific question, and it is kind of answered by religions, but it's kind of answered non-rationally, right? You know, you have like questions about just the general nature of the world. Is everything predetermined, or do we have free will? Does the universe have a beginning, or did it always exist? And it's sort of like, well, if you don't think those are important, then what is? Like, that's those are sort of like the biggest questions there are, right?
But yes.
So, yeah, I mean, although like some people just don't find these interesting, or they just don't like them. And if that's the case, I can't really do anything about that, right?
yes, a man named Brian Kaplan wrote this book, Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. And on page 165, he summarized a lot of philosophical theories. So I want to list off a philosophical theory, Kaplan's brief summary, and let me know what you think about this theory in general. Utilitarianism, maximize the sum of human happiness.
Yeah, so the only error in there is the word human. most utilitarians think you should maximize, well, okay, happiness could also be an error, but they think that you should maximize enjoyment. And that applies to any being that can have enjoyment. Most utilitarians are, you know, animal welfare advocates like Peter Singer.
And is this something you think is a legitimate philosophy, or are there major holes in it?
I wouldn't say it's illegitimate, but I don't believe it's true, right? So what's wrong with utilitarianism? I mean, there's just a series of intuitive counterexamples, i.e. you can describe situations in which the theory recommends something that strikes most people as clearly wrong, right? So maybe, you know, the most famous example is you have a healthy patient in the hospital and you have five other patients who need organ transplants. And somehow the one healthy guy is compatible with the other five. And so here's something you could do. You could murder the healthy patient and then distribute his organs to the five other patients, right? And they all need different organs. So, you know, like a lung, a kidney, a heart, or liver, or whatever. And so you could save five lives at the cost of one life. So on a utilitarian calculus, you know, you're up four lives. So you have to do it, right? Not only permissible, but actually it's obligatory. It would be wrong if you don't murder the healthy patient, right? And that strikes most people as wrong. And there's just a whole bunch of examples that are like that, right? Where it looks like you shouldn't do the thing that produces overall greater enjoyment.
Oh, yes. The second one is egalitarianism from the point of John Rawls. He says, inequalities must benefit the worst off. You think that is a good philosophy?
No. I mean, there's a number of things that I think went wrong with Rawls, right? But I mean, one of the fundamental things is thinking that, thinking that there's somebody who's responsible for the overall distribution of stuff, right? And they're like somebody needs to justify the overall distribution. I think that somebody, you know, people are responsible for individual pieces of property, and you can justify why a particular individual gets to have a particular piece of property because of what the person did to acquire it, right? But then it turns out that there's some overall pattern where there's inequality, like one person wound up having more than another person. And that could be because the person who has more did more productive activity, right? And it doesn't have to be that. There are other reasons, like a person with more could have just gotten lucky, okay? But Rawls's philosophy applies, it's supposed to apply across the board, right? So I'm not allowed to get more stuff by being more productive without justifying it to the people who are worse off. Like, I have to pay off the poorer people to let me be more productive right, to let me keep a portion of the stuff that I produced, right? I have to justify why I get to do that by saying, well, I'm going to give to the people who didn't produce, right? And I don't see why that's true, right?
Sure. Kaplan summarizes libertarianism as from each as he chooses to each as he has chosen. He is trying to summarize them in very, he gets five of them onto one page. But what are your thoughts on libertarianism and that definition of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's very brief, right? By the way, that phrase came from Robert Nozick, right? And of course, like in case any of the readers don't know, this is like a, in contrast to Karl Marx's dictum, from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Right. And so Nozick's idea was, well, you know, libertarians have a different principle for distribution. It's that, you know, we, like the Marxists say, you should just contribute according to whatever you're able to contribute to society. And Nozick says, no, you know, you should contribute what you choose to contribute. You don't have to contribute anything. You could just sit on your ass all day. And then to each as they're chosen, what he meant by that was, well, you get money when other people who have it give it to you, right? So, and they don't, like, not when you force them to give it to you, but when they choose to give it to you, right? And like that, yeah, it seems like a good idea, right? That is in general a good idea. As readers know, I am myself a libertarian. I was going to say an extreme libertarian in the sense that I'm an anarchist, although I think I'm not as extreme as many other libertarians are.
The cost-benefit analysis put forth by Richard Posner says, maximize the total value of social resources. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, that sounds utilitarian. So it might have a problem of ignoring people's rights. So, you know, like the example with harvesting the organs, right? Looks like that would justify turning everybody's organs into assets, you know, that other people can just take if they need them more and all that. Okay, so I don't like that, but I do think that you should go through a cost-benefit analysis before implementing a policy, because I think it's a necessary condition on, you know, like the government passing restrictions. It's not sufficient, but it's necessary that whatever new laws or regulations they're making are gonna work, right? And like not produce more harm than good, or, you know, not be counterproductive to their aims and things like that. So you should at minimum look at how much it's costing and how much benefit it's producing.
Kaplan summarizes Christianity as do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Is that something that you think is consistent or can be morally justified?
Well, so first, I don't think that's a fair summary of Christianity, because there is no mention of Jesus in that summary, but or God, right? But anyway, is that a good moral principle? Generally, yes, but it's sort of imprecise. It's not going to get everything, right? So, you know, an example that I heard was, what if there's like this snake worshiper who wants to be thrown in a pit of snakes? And so therefore, he throws other people in a pit of snakes. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, don't always do what you want other people to do to you, right? But still, like, there's an underlying insight, right? Which is sort of that when you're doing stuff, you should sort of, like, try to see from other people's perspective how the thing that you're doing looks, right? And, you know, not just always think in terms of what you want.
And finally, Kantianism, treat every person as an end in himself, never as a mere means.
Yeah, there's there's a good insight in this, right? But it's also not entirely correct, right? So, you know, it's closely related to libertarianism, which also appears in Nozick's book, in Anarchy, State, and Utopia. He suggests that people have rights because of this Kantian idea. The reason why you can't violate their rights is basically because respecting people's rights is treating them as ends of themselves. What's wrong with the Kantian principle is just that I think there are exceptions to it. So, you know, if you had to kill one innocent person in order to save the entire rest of the human species, I think you should do it, right? Even though that's violating the principle. Mm-hmm. Kant would say, no, right? You can't do it even to save everyone else, okay? You know, here's like a, maybe let's make it more extreme so it's more obvious to people, right? So if you had to pluck a single hair off an innocent person's head without their consent, and that would save the rest of humanity, I think you should do it. Okay, even though that would be treating that one person as a means and not as an end in themselves.
Got it. Yes, finding exceptions. In Anarchy, State, and Utopia, Nozick has the experience machine where he says, suppose there were an experience machine that would give you any experience you desire. Super duper neuropsychologists could simulate your brain so that you would think and feel you were writing a great novel or making a friend or reading an interesting book. All the time you would be floating in a tank with electrodes attached to your brain. Should you plug into the machine for life, programming your life's experiences? Would you plug in?
No.
Why?
Most people would not plug in. Although I think that it depends on how good your life is. So if you have a shitty life, I think you should plug in. But if your life is going pretty good, I don't think you should plug in. But, you know, basically, yeah, I basically agree with Nozick's discussion there, right? Like, well, we want to live in contact with reality. We want to make actual achievements, not merely have the experience of making an achievement. So, like, if somebody wants to climb Mount Everest, they don't merely want to be deceived into thinking that they climbed Mount Everest. They want to actually do it. Because, like, you know, playing a virtual reality simulation of climbing the mountain is not a great achievement. Actually climbing it is a great achievement, right? And you know, like, yeah, you can imagine.
I was going to say, so what is it that, you know, is really pushing people to not plug in? Is it because you, in the real world, you actually have an effect on the lives of other real humans who have the ability to feel emotions? Or is it you actually achieving something on your own, as opposed to it not, being a false reality?
Yeah, I mean, it's both, right? So like a utilitarian or altruist would say, oh no, I can't plug in because then I won't be helping other people, right? Because, you know, then the person who plugs in will be having great experiences, but he won't be causing other people to have great experiences, right? So, okay, but even if you could plug everyone in, right? Imagine you could just make everyone be plugged into the experience machine forever. I still don't think you should do that, right? Okay, so, like, you know, it's a valid point that you won't, like, if you have a family, you'll be abandoning your family, right?
Mm.
Like, your kids will just grow up on their own if you have any kids, right? So that's kind of bad. But also, like, even if you imagine that you could plug all of them into the experience machine, too, it still wouldn't seem so great. And that's partly because, like, everything that you're doing, like, everything you experience is a lie. All of your projects are just a lie, right? Like, you think that you did something worthwhile, and it's just a complete deception because, you know, you didn't actually do it.
Right. Let's say, oh, I'm sorry, did you have anything else on that?
No, go ahead.
Let's say we have two different people who have both stabbed and killed someone. One person was in a kitchen, very stressed out, slipped with a knife and killed someone. It was a terrible accident. The person's very upset. In the second scenario, a guy felt as though he was insulted and then intentionally stabbed the guy to kill him. So in both scenarios, we have people who have taken knives and ended the lives of innocent, peaceful people. Do you think there should be a difference in their sentencing and how they are treated?
This seems like an easy question.
So if the answer is yes, what is the explanation for why these two people should be treated differently, considering they did the same thing?
One of them deserves worse treatment than the other one. That's like the short version of the answer, right? Why does he deserve worse treatment? Okay, because one of them intended to kill another person and the other one didn't intend. Like, you know, the intention is part of responsibility. The one who did it by accident could still have some negative deserve because maybe they should have been more careful. You know, but like intentionally killing someone, just deliberately trying to kill someone is worse than merely being careless or whatever. So, right.
Do you think it's immoral to drive drunk?
Well, to some degree, right? I mean, let's say it's morally wrong to drive very drunk without having a really good reason, right?
Yeah. And why is that?
Imposes an unreasonable risk on others. So, yeah, so like you're allowed to impose some risk, but at a certain, like if it becomes excessive and you don't need to do it, then at some point it becomes immoral.
Yes. The book is Knowledge, Reality, and Value. In a lot of your ethical thinking, you use a common sense morality approach. Why do you use that as opposed to, say, a strict deontological approach?
Because I care about the truth. That's the short version, right? So just in general, the way that human beings know things, the way that human beings learn is starting from the concrete and generalizing to the abstract, not the other way around. And so I observe just as a general matter in almost all areas, if you start from abstract generalizations and then start deducing consequences from it, it doesn't work. It goes badly. So because what happens is like you start from an abstract generalization that sounds good to you at the start, but it's totally wrong. And you're not going to notice that it's totally wrong until you look at particular examples. But then if you're, you know, dogmatic in the way that most philosophers historically have been, you just deduce the false consequences and just embrace them because, you know, because of the order in which these thoughts occur to you, because you started with the abstract generalization and then only later saw the counterexamples. So then you just insist that the thing that you started with has to be true. Like this is a thing that has happened repeatedly in the history of philosophy. No, but basically it's super hard to come up with a universal generalization that's always true without first going through a ton of examples. You have to first go through all the concrete examples to see what you think about them before you can reasonably generalize, right? And so that's part of what I'm doing. Like, so my approach to ethics is I look at a concrete example where there's a pretty uncontroversial intuitive verdict about it. And then I draw an analogy between that and a case that is controversial in order to try to resolve the controversy.
In the book, you mention the unappreciated idea that most people throughout all of history were generally accepted the concept of slavery. And today they widely say that it is something terrible. How do you think blatantly unjustified institutions are able to exist for so long without being questioned?
Yeah, good question, right? So, I mean, part of the answer is status quo bias. Most people have a huge bias in favor of whatever way things are currently being done in their own society. And, you know, part of the answer is most people are just not reflective. So they just don't think. They just do not ask themselves whether this is okay. They just keep doing it because that's what other people are doing. And also part of the answer is like most people are naturally bad, right? Like people are extremely selfish and have a very small amount of moral motivation, right? And so it's just gonna like, it's gonna take a long time. It's gonna take a long time for them to figure out what's right, you know, when most people are not trying to figure it out, right?
So why would you say that things like murder, rape, and slavery are wrong? If is there any way outside of the common sense morality approach, if you're talking to someone who lives in a society where murder, rape, and slavery are sort of just the norm?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any society in which murder and rape are okay, but I would add a qualification. There are many societies in which it would be accepted to attack a neighboring tribe. You attack another society and murder and rape those people. Yeah. That's been widely accepted. But murdering and raping within your tribe, not okay. But anyway, yeah, what would I say to this? All right, so, and then, you know, slavery widely practiced, as we said. So, and what would I say to the people in those societies? Like, if they wanted to reason with me, I'm, you know, I would like start saying, okay, so you think that it's okay to attack these neighboring tribes? Why? How are they different from you? They're like, they seem like a lot like you and the people in your tribe. You know, they have their own concerns, their own lives that they're trying to lead, and, you know, the same sorts of concerns that you have, and they love their families just like you do. And so, like, why do you think that they're different so you can attack them? And I think they basically would have no answer to that. I think they would have just never thought of it. Now, I don't think that I would actually succeed, because I think that the people in the primitive tribes would just refuse to entertain the moral questions, because I think they would not care.
Do you have a general method for determining morally justified behavior from immoral? So, like, for example, if pretend you had never heard of jury duty for the first time, and you find out in America there is something where people are compulsed to serve on a jury in order to determine the guilt or innocence of someone on trial. How would you go about determining right from wrong behavior?
Well, you mean whether it's okay to force them to serve, or what they should do when they're on the jury?
I was just using that as an example of when most people who I speak with on this haven't really sat down and thought about whether it's justified. They just say, of course it is, and then move on, and then treat me like a prick when I ask any follow-up questions. How would you determine whether this was justified or unjustified?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the general thing is I would try to think of something else that most people agree with that is analogous, right? So, like, what if I have some work that needs to be done here in my condo? I got some stuff that needs to be fixed. And what if I just like pick a random person and force them to come up and do the work for me? That's not all right, is it? Right. And then I just say, you know, isn't that kind of analogous to the government saying, oh, we have some work that needs to be done. We're just going to pick random people and force them to do it. Right. You know, why is that different? And then, you know, and then you have to have a discussion when they try to say that it's different, and you discuss whether it really is different in the way that they say or whatever.
And how do you find that difference? So often I'll be in a discussion or just thinking about something myself, and I'll know that something is different, but it's hard to determine whether it's arbitrarily different or it's different in principle. How can you tell if something's different arbitrarily or different in principle?
Well, I mean, you just try to think of what the differences are, then you ask yourself if those are relevant. And sometimes it just seems obvious that it's not, right? But if you think of something that seems like it's relevant, then you try to think of other examples, right? You try to think of examples that remove that difference, okay? So you go, there's the difference that the jury duty, it's the government forcing you and not somebody else. Maybe that's relevant, okay? So what if the government forces you to go dig ditches? Is that okay? Okay, they want to build a new highway, and they just like grab people, random people, and just say, okay, you're now highway worker, right? And you're just sitting there, you know, with the cops holding guns pointing at you to make sure that you keep digging. Like, that doesn't seem okay, really. Anyway, so yeah, you just have to like sort of try to think of what the differences might be and try to think if any of them are relevant.
Michael Sandel wrote a book called What Money Can't Buy: The Moral Limits of Markets. And he says, why worry that we are moving toward a society in which everything is up for sale? For two reasons: inequality and corruption. Consider inequality. In a society where everything is up for sale, life is harder for those of modest means. The more money can buy, the more affluence, or lack of it, matters. Putting a price on the good things in life can also corrupt them. That's because markets don't only allocate goods, they also express and promote certain attitudes towards the goods being exchanged. What do you think about that from the standpoint of someone who's a libertarian?
Yeah, which is always my standpoint. there are two arguments there. One is, it makes life more difficult for people of modest means. I don't think that's true. So like the possibility of buying something can make your life easier. And if you can't afford it, then it doesn't make your life easier. But having people prohibit you from buying it doesn't help either, because you still can't buy it then, right? Right, okay, so I think about things like kidney sales. Like, all right, should I be able to get paid for donating a kidney so that some person who needs it can survive? And then, you know, because that's illegal, it's impossible for anyone to buy it. That doesn't mean that now poor people get kidneys. They still don't get kidneys because they still can't buy them. Like the back then, now it's just that nobody can buy them. That doesn't mean the poor people are better off. If you could sell them, at least the wealthy people could get them, at least their lives will be saved. The poor people will be just as dead. I know. Anyway, okay. But also, you know, if you're worried about the poor, this is a different solution. This isn't my view, but this is a more rational view. Just subsidize it. If you're worried that the poor people won't be able to afford the kidneys, have the government, you know, just like subsidize the purchase of kidneys so that they could buy it, right? Give them like a kidney voucher or something.
Yeah.
And then the other argument that he had there was something about expressing attitudes, like, oh, you'll be expressing the wrong attitudes towards kidneys or whatever. Like, I assume that's one of the main things that he's thinking about, right? Selling body parts. And I just think, you know, I don't know if it's true, but I think it's just a completely trivial consideration, right? Like, oh, you'll be expressing a bad attitude about kidneys if you sell one or if you buy one. Okay, I think that's totally trivial in comparison with the avoidable death of the kidney disease sufferers, right? Okay, and like, here's an example that I have. So compare two cases, right? Case one, Ted murders Sarah. Case two, Jill says, Jack is an asshole and his interests and rights don't matter. And then she puts that on a giant billboard by the freeway where everyone sees, you know, Jack's life doesn't matter. And then she tweets it to her 10 million followers. Okay, so those are two different things that you could do. Murdering the person and putting out this message. Which one is worse? Okay, and how much worse? Okay, I think the first one, I think the actual murdering is like about a billion times worse than putting up the billboard and putting up the offensive tweet. And what this shows is that sending negative messages is like a trivial harm. It's a trivial wrong in comparison with the death of a human being, right? The problem with Ted murdering Sarah is not that it conveyed a bad message about Sarah. It's that Sarah is now dead, right? And so similarly with this, you know, kidney sale issue, all of these people dying just swamps the badness of people sending negative messages or, you know, whatever the message is supposed to be.
Yes, Jason Brennan wrote about that in a great book. I think it's titled, I can't believe it's slipping my mind.
Markets Without Limits?
Markets Without Limits, yes, thank you. He said there's about 100,000 people on the kidney waiting list, and the vast majority are going to die because of this legislation that stops people from compensating others for giving them their kidney. Let's take an example similar to the message one. Do you think it's immoral for me to say start a campaign that everyone should force Ted to give me money? I don't know who this guy is, but I know he lives near me. People should force him to give me money, or we should all collectively put him in a cage and then shoot him if he resists. I think people would say that is unjustified. However, this is in principle no different than advocating socialism or taxation. Is someone immoral for advocating socialism, and should that be illegal?
I guess it's immoral, yeah. I don't think it should be illegal. But, you know, like, I mean, just like that thing, you know, saying that your neighbor should be put in a cage unless he agrees to give you money. I think you shouldn't say that, but I wouldn't put you in jail if you say that, right? Why not? And, you know, so one of the things that we have to consider about, like, when you're making laws is we have to think about the overall effect on, you know, society if the government is able to make laws about, you know, what political positions you can advocate, right? So even if it's totally immoral to advocate this political position, if the government is there deciding what political positions are immoral and like prohibiting you from advocating the ones that it thinks are immoral, you know, we're going to totalitarianism, right? I mean, they're obviously just going to use that power to prevent anyone from criticizing them. And then, and, you know, like that's what happens in communist dictatorships and so on, right? So that's one problem. You know, the other thing is, I mean, just like from a philosophical standpoint, mere words are not a sufficient provocation for violence. So like, right, I mean, except in exceptional circumstances, let's say, right? Right, but most of the time, if you're just saying, hey, you know, somebody should do something wrong, But, you know, like, just in general, you're just like throwing it out there to the world that people should do some things which in fact are wrong. Usually that's not enough of a reason for other people to do violence against you.
What is the thesis of your book, Ethical Intuitionism?
Yeah. By the way, I'm glad that you pronounced that correctly, because about half of people who interview me and use that title mispronounce it.
I bought the book and read it. So yes.
Some people call it intuitivism. Other people call it institutionalism. But, you know, intuitionism. Anyway. Yeah, I mean, there's a few ideas in ethical intuitionism, right? So one important idea is that there are objective values. There are objective facts about something being right, wrong, good, or bad. Like, it's objectively wrong to torture babies for fun. Another thing is about how we know this, and roughly we know this because we have ethical intuitions. These ethical intuitions are cases where when you just sort of intellectually reflect on some question, something seems to you right or wrong. Like, when I think about torturing babies for fun, it just seems wrong to me. And so that's ethical intuition. The way that I know that it's wrong is it seems wrong to me, and I have no reason for thinking otherwise, no reason for doubting that intuition. And then there's another part about what reasons we have for action, which is basically you have reasons for action in virtue of having these ethical beliefs, like independent of your desires. So even if you want to torture babies, you have a reason for not doing it because presumably you have the intuition that it's wrong to do it, hopefully.
What is the thesis of your book, Dialogues on Vegetarianism?
Yeah, Dialogues on Ethical Vegetarianism. It's wrong to buy products from factory farms, right? Which, you know, mostly people are buying meat from factory farms. And most of the time people are eating meat that they got from factory farms. That's like 99% or something. Okay, so the short version is stop eating meat. Right? And the more precise version is stop buying products that come from factory farms.
And this is because they engage in killing animals, which involves the animal suffering?
Right, yeah. So, you know, factory farms are the source of something like 99% of the animal products in the world. And we're killing something in the neighborhood of 74 billion animals per year in order to get these products, you know, because we like feasting on their flesh because it's fun. Okay. And that's like, you know, that's close to 10 times the entire human population of the world. And then, you know, if you like, you can go online and look at these videos of what the conditions are like in the factory farms, and it's basically like torture. Like, if you were holding a person in those conditions, we would say you were torturing the person, right? And so, like, the total amount of suffering that we're causing every year is astronomical, let's say, right? It's clearly greater than all the human suffering that's going on. In fact, a few years of factory farming might produce more suffering than all the suffering in human history. That's actually a fairly plausible estimate, right? Because there have only ever been 110 billion humans, and we're killing 74 billion animals every year. So like 2 years, we kill more animals than all the humans who've ever existed. And we tortured most of them for months before killing them, right? So it's plausible that we're inflicting more suffering than all the suffering in human history every few years.
Wow. Yeah, that is definitely a very good point. Now, one hurdle to that could be, well, is the problem the type of factory farm and the method of killing and the method of holding them before killing? In other words, if all those were sort of more or less solved, there was an open field and the killing was just a quick shot that they didn't even feel and you did it while they were asleep, would that justify killing animals for the purpose of eating them?
I'm not sure. So, I mean, you know, this has... So, like, I mean, first, I'm not sure this is practically relevant because I'm not sure that that's like a thing that might happen. But there is, you know, there are these sort of free range animal products, and there are these animal welfare organizations that go and, you know, examine farms to make sure that they're humane. And then sometimes you see this humane certified label on products, which means one of these animal welfare organizations examined, you know, their practices and decided it was humane enough. And so you could have a reasonable question about whether it's okay to buy those products. Now, I think it's questionable because you're still saying, like, you know, it's like I can end the life of this other creature just because I get a little more pleasure, like just for fun, right? It's like a little bit more pleasure during meal times. Like, if that's the only reason, that does strike me as pretty questionable. If you have a stronger reason, then I think it's okay, right? So, like, if you have like a medical reason why you need the animal products, then I think it's okay, you know, to kill them painlessly without all the torture.
In the happiness hypothesis, Jonathan Haidt has a short, of course, fake story to try to display the difficulty of winning an argument. He says, Julie and Mark are sister and brother. They are traveling together in France on summer vacation from college. One night, they are staying alone in a cabin near a beach. They decide it would be interesting and fun if they tried making love. At the very least, it would be a new experience for each of them. Julie is already taking birth control, but Mark uses a condom too, just to be safe. They both enjoy making love, but decide not to do it again. They keep that night a special secret, which makes them feel even closer to each other. Do you think this is acceptable for two consenting adults who happen to be siblings make love? How would you justify that judgment?
Yeah. So wait, so you're asking me if it's okay?
No, no, the whole point is, okay, your position, let's say it's an obvious no. Well, how would you justify that?
No, I don't see anything wrong with it. I don't see what the problem is, right? Okay, but I know that because I know partly because I'm a normal human being and also because I've read Jonathan Haidt's work that most people say it's not okay. And then they try to explain why, and then they give false reasons, right? They say, oh, well, you know, like there's a risk of birth defects from incest, right? And by the way, that really only shows up after you do multiple generations of incestuous breeding. So, and anyway, Haidt put into the scenario that they use two forms of birth control. So it's super improbable that there would be any child at all. So, right? Like you put all these things in the scenario to try to eliminate the negative consequences that are supposed to result, right? So then at that point, I'm not really sure what the problem is, right? Like, I think there would be problems if they're interbreeding for multiple generations and producing offspring. I think there would be problems if they're going around telling everybody else that incest is great and they're doing it. But, you know, in the scenario as described, they don't really see the problem.
Do you think it's immoral for people to actively promote political policies that they have done little to no research on?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's slightly immoral because the chances of your actually having an effect on public policy are very small. But it's immoral because, you know, there's a chance that you're going to cause other people's rights to be violated and cause just harm in general. Even if you don't believe in rights, there's still a pretty good chance that you're going to be causing harm, you know, in the unlikely event that you have an influence. There's a pretty good chance that the thing that you're advocating would be harmful overall. And, you know, you don't have to do it. You can keep your mouth shut, right? But I think most people don't realize how likely this is. I think basically if you have not researched something, there's almost 100% chance that you're wrong about a bunch of stuff about it. Like the just casual impression that you have is almost always wrong in multiple different respects.
He goes on to talk about the myth of pure evil. Haidt says, when taking the perpetrator's perspective, he found, this researcher, that people who do things we see as evil, from spousal abuse all the way to genocide, rarely think they are doing anything wrong. They almost always see themselves as responding to attacks and provocations in some ways that are justified. They often think they themselves are the victims. What do you think about what he calls the myth of pure evil?
I think this might be sort of giving too much credit to the bullshit that evil people say. Yeah. Right? Like, right. So I don't know how this study was done, but here's how I'm imagining it happening. you go to somebody who did something horribly wrong and you say, hey, why did you do that? And then they come up with some story about why it was a good thing to do. And then the researcher just takes that at face value, right? Take that bullshit story at face value. Okay, and so I think the fact that somebody comes up with that story, like they might just be lying for the benefit of other people because they're manipulators. And so, and you know, it might not be that they really sincerely think that they did the right thing or that they cared what the right thing was. It might be that just they did what they wanted to serve their own interests. And then after the fact, they made up a bullshit rationalization to tell other people so that other people would be nicer to them or something like that, right? Some of the people who are doing terrible things are actually psychopaths. And the psychopaths will often say something about why the thing they did was okay. And, you know, often they will say some completely ridiculous thing. Like, it was okay to murder this person because he was in my way. He shouldn't have been in my way or whatever. It was his fault because he was in my way. There's a time when a psychopath said, you know, he learned a hard lesson in reference to somebody the psychopath had murdered, right? Like, yeah. You know, as if you were giving them a valuable lesson by murdering them. Okay. Anyway, so part of what's going on is some of the people just do not give a shit and do not understand morality, right? And so they're saying like ridiculous rationalizations. They're not sincerely trying to figure out what's rational. Okay. All that being said, so I think there are some people who are evil. That being said, there are not that many of them. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking to yourself like, oh, Republicans are evil. No, right? It's not going to be like half the population is evil, right? Like, I think maybe psychopaths are evil, or I don't know, maybe they're just amoral because they don't even understand what morality is. But, you know, maybe there's a small number of people who are pure evil, like maybe Hitler and Stalin. But it's not going to be like the Trump supporters, whom they're like 50 million. It's actually like 50 million people are pure evil.
Be impossible to get anything done. What do you think about the idea that morality does not exist? It's just as made up as languages, and the only reason we believe it is because we sort of just trick ourselves into justifying customs. There is nothing objectively wrong with me, say, killing someone because their life ends, their life is going to end anyway. Yes, it hurts them, but so does, you know, someone breaking up with you. That also hurts you, but that's not something terribly evil. So therefore, morality is non-existent.
Well, okay, wait. I mean, the argument for why it's okay to kill people is really lame, right? Okay to break up with someone, and that's pretty much like killing someone, so that's okay. Anyway, yeah, what do I think about the idea that morality is just made up? False? That seems false. why do I think that's false? Well, it seems to me like it's wrong to torture babies for fun. That seems to me about as obvious as anything is. So if someone was going to try to convince me that that's not actually wrong, they would have to have an amazing argument. So they would have to have some information that is more obvious than the fact that it's wrong to torture babies for fun. And that information would have to somehow contradict the wrongness of torturing babies, right? And I just don't see that happening, right? I see, like, the arguments that people give for this position, I find extremely weak. Right? Like, you know, nowhere near as obvious, right? So, like, one of the arguments is, this is an argument that you find in the academic ethics literature. If there were objective values, then they would be intrinsically motivating, i.e. they would motivate people to act independent of people's desires. But it's impossible for any fact to be intrinsically motivating. Therefore, there can't be any objective value. Okay, and like, that's not like a complete non sequitur, right? It's like it's not a completely worthless argument, right? But neither of those premises is anywhere near as obvious as the premise that it's wrong to torture babies for fun, right? So like, there's no way I'm gonna give up my ethical belief because of these dubious claims, right? It's not obvious that, objective moral facts have to be intrinsically motivating, and it's not obvious that nothing can be intrinsically motivating either.
You have a great book called Paradox Lost. I want to give you one that I heard the other day. This is from Kim Jong-un, the father of the sitting the sitting tyrant of North Korea, he said that he was one of the wisest men in the land because he discovered that 1 + 1 = 1. If you have one drop of water and you add another drop of water, you have one drop of water. That was his logic. If you were to explain to the people of North Korea that this actually does not make sense, even though on the surface level it does, what would you say to them?
So I have to explain why 1 + 1 = 1?
Yes, because many of them believe that story to be a legitimate representation of his wisdom, thus his justification in ruling them.
I see. Well, I mean, it seems like we could give a counterexample, like I could take a rock and another rock and show how it's two rocks. Like, wouldn't that refute the generalization? Now, okay, so, and then you might say, oh, so like, there's no generalization. You know, 1 + 1 is indeterminate. There's no answer to what it is, right? No, so, wait, was this Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-il who was saying this?
What did I say? This was, who did he write the, Kim Jong-il. This is who Michael Malice wrote the biography about. So Kim, okay. This is the son of Kim Il-sung. Yes.
Okay, yeah. So I think that he's misunderstood what addition is. So I think that, you know, 1 + 1, well, actually, by the way, the factual claim is not even true, right? It depends on the size of the drop. So if you put them together, you might, like if you put two small drops, maybe it makes one big drop. But if you put two big drops, maybe it makes something like bigger than a drop. So anyway, but that's not what addition means. It doesn't refer to a physical operation in which like you physically attach two things to each other and make them in physical contact. That's not what it means, right? 1 + 1 refers to a situation in which there's something and there's another thing, right? And 1 + 1 = 2 means when there's a thing and there's another thing, then there are two things, right? That's all it means. Right. And why do I think that's what it means? Because that explains how we use the phrase, right? Like that's why we say 1 + 1 = 2. To like interpret the thing to mean what it obviously means to make sense of what people are saying, right?
If someone were just on an island by themselves, never going to see anyone again, do you think that person could still act in moral and immoral ways?
I guess I would say no. According to how I think the word immoral is usually used. So I think the person could act in rational and irrational ways, mm-hmm. like do things that they do or don't have good reason to do and like, you know, whatever. But I don't think I would call it immoral when they did the irrational things. Because I think the way the word moral is used in English, it has to refer to non-selfish reasons for action.
What are some of your favorite thought experiments?
I don't know. I like the Chinese room thought experiment. I like that because, it kind of convinced me that, you couldn't just program a computer to think. You know this example?
No, I don't.
Okay. So, you know, there are these people in the artificial intelligence community who say, here's the way that you determine if a computer can think, right? You have the computer communicating via terminal to a person. And so the person is communicating with a computer and a real person. And then the person has to figure out which thing that he's communicating with is human and which is a computer. And if he can't figure it out, that proves that the computer is conscious, right? Or the computer is thinking or understanding or whatever in the same sense that we're thinking, right? So that's the claim by the artificial intelligence people, at least some of them. And then here's the thought experiment. So imagine that computer programmers have come up with this program that simulates conversation in Chinese. And this program is so good that when you interact with it, you can't tell the difference between it and the native Chinese speaker. And then imagine that you transcribe the rules of this program in a giant rule book, right? And the rule book just says, you know, when you see this, and there's a picture of a sequence of Chinese symbols, you do this. And like you do these calculations and you put out these, and then there's another picture of these symbols, right? The rule book doesn't say what any of these symbols mean. It just tells you to do calculations when you see symbols with a certain shape and put out other symbols with a certain shape, okay? So you put me in a room with this giant rule book. And then people are putting things in a slot in the room, which have these collections of Chinese symbols. And I look up in the rule book what I'm supposed to do, and I pass the appropriate symbols out of the room. And because I'm implementing the same algorithm, you know, I pass the test, right? That pass the same test that the computer did. Okay. And, but I don't understand a word of Chinese.
Mm.
And, you know, there's no way that I would understand it just by following those rules. Right. And so if I don't understand any Chinese just by implementing the program for understanding Chinese, then there's no way that any other digital computer would understand Chinese, because it doesn't have anything that I don't have.
And any other favorite thought experiments you have?
You know, I mean, there are various of these examples in ethics, like the organ harvesting, right, which is the counterexample to utilitarianism. That's pretty good. I think the violinist thought experiment about abortion is pretty good. And I'm not saying that it proves that abortion is okay, but it's definitely a good example to think about. In case anyone doesn't know this, this is, you know, you imagine that there's this world famous violinist who has to be attached to a person for 9 months, like physically attached to another person, because he's got some kind of kidney disease, right? And like he has to use somebody else's kidneys to filter out toxins in his blood, right? And so some society of music lovers has kidnapped you without your knowledge and attached you. Like you didn't agree to it, but they attached you to the violinist. And now your body is filtering out the toxins in his blood. And if they detach you, then, or if you detach yourself, then the violinist will die, right? And then, you know, you're supposed to think it's okay to detach yourself. You don't have to stay attached to this other person for 9 months. Even if they're going to die if you detach yourself, you still don't have to stay. So if you agree with that, then you're supposed to conclude that it's okay to remove a fetus from your body, even though it's going to die, even if the fetus is a person.
Yeah. What if I am, I choose to go to a place where I know there's a pretty good chance that I'll get stuck with a violinist next to me for 9 months, and I keep going back to this place again and again, and then one time I wake up and the violinist is attached to me, and I go, oh, poor, woe is me. Now I need the state to fund the violinist removal at violinist parenthood. then do you think I would be justified in, even though I keep going to the place knowing what the risk is?
Yeah, you typically don't lose your right to have a remedy if you go somewhere where you're at risk of something bad happening to you, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, what if you're going to a dangerous neighborhood and like somebody mugs you and takes your money? Okay, and then later you complain and you demand that the mugger pay you back. And he goes, no, because you came to the neighborhood and you knew it was a dangerous neighborhood. So now I get to keep the money. Like, no. Right. So, you know, it doesn't, like, even if you knew there was a risk, it doesn't mean that you agreed to have it happen.
Final question. Who are some of your favorite philosophers?
Let's see. I like Descartes, you know, the so-called founder of modern philosophy, because I like that whole I think, therefore I am thing. Even though he was confused about some things. I like John Searle, as you might have guessed from the Chinese realm example. I like David Stove, who is a little known philosopher of science from Australia, but he's like the most hilarious philosophical writer, you know, like ridiculing the other philosophers of science and so on. So those are good. I like Jason Brennan, of course.
Awesome. Well, the book is Knowledge, Reality, and Value, A Mostly Common Sense Guide to Philosophy. Dr. Humer, where is the best place to find, there of course will be a link to purchase the Amazon book. Where's the best place to find your archive of work?
Well, so I have a website, owl232.net, owl232.net. And then there's a link to my blog, and there's like, there will be a link to some of my papers and links to some of my books, you know, which the links would take you outside, would take you to Amazon. So.
Perfect. Those links will be in the description below. Thank you to everyone for watching Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. And thank you, Dr. Humer, for being so generous with your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.